This is a young man that I love very much, and I know that most of you do also. And in order to get what is a more true story than what we hear, might I say, on most of our television stations, this Dan Hare went over to Iraq and had the experience of waking up in Saddam's home. Can you believe that? Right over there in this wartime, he just marched right in there. And how long were we there? 2 weeks?
The whole trip was about 12 days.
Seemed like a long time to me, but anyhow. This is our Dan here.
Thank you. You know, it's, yeah, I was in Iraq. What a trip. It was, I'm doing a documentary film, and just to give you some context, I was invited by a group that organized a tour. It was called the Voices of Soldiers Tour. And it was a group of radio talk show hosts, and they asked me to go along and document their trip. And their whole mission was to go and broadcast their radio talk shows from, actually from CENTCOM in Tampa, Florida. That's where Central Command is at. From, I forget the base name, but in Kuwait. And then also in Baghdad. And the purpose was to allow soldiers to speak unfettered and not to be interpreted or some spin put on it. Just let them talk to the various audiences. We had a talk show out of San Francisco, Sacramento, Washington, D.C., the Tri-County area, and down in Florida. And then just to thank the soldiers for their efforts. And I'll tell you, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. You know, first to go to Iraq, you know, there's so much attention on it. And to kind of get the frontline scoop, as it were. And then to see the incredible men and women that serve in our military. I have never been so impressed in my life. Just some of the most dynamic and smart and pragmatic, and they know their mission, and an amazing trip. But to give you kind of a summary of it, we went down to Central Command. It was about 95 degrees. We broadcast from there. There were 71 nations that were they were really like trailers from countries as small as Estonia, Romania, some really small countries were there and represented. And we were able to interact with them and interview them and tape them and that sort of thing. And then we went on to, and it was real interesting because in the beginning, they almost canceled our trip because they're very skeptical about media. Because the media comes in and they tend to take things and skew them to the worst possible denominator. And when they realized that we wanted to let the soldiers talk, to let the story be told and not, like, put some spin on it, they started to warm up to us. And they almost canceled us even the day before. That's how tentative the thing was, because there were certain people in the media that were saying that this was a propaganda tour and all that sort of thing. And so it was amazing when we were in Central Command, General Abizade, who heads up Central Command, was supposed to be the briefing that we got. And we got a briefing of what the duties and the area of responsibilities included, which was basically the Middle East, Cape Horn, and Africa. And it's amazing some of the things that go on in this world that we just don't have a clue, or at least I did. And I'm kind of a news junkie. And they said the Middle East and terrorism is definitely a problem. It's a cultural problem. And it goes beyond boundaries. It's a cultural, ideological type of a war. But then he was talking about the generals, not General Abizade. He actually couldn't make it, but his seat was empty. And they were talking about things in Africa that are going on. And some of the situations that we face in this world in 20 to 30 years from now, in countries that are exploding in population and are reducing of their resources, particularly water. And they're making a lot of infrastructure things, the Army Corps of Engineers. And they talked about that, and they talked about some geopolitical things, not in a partisan way in America, but in kind of a global thing. And it's really about economic development, so people can have a basic, decent, you know, house over their, or roof over their head, and something to feed their family and to have an existence. And they basically said that when people have that, they generally don't shoot at you. I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And so we left there, and we left for Kuwait through Frankfurt. And from Frankfurt, we went to Kuwait. And I think by the time we got into Baghdad, I didn't know what day or what time it was, but I think we'd been on the traveling for about 24 hours. And we got in at 2 in the morning, and they suited us up with our, they sized us, we had to send our sizes in, with our helmet and, you know, the flak jackets that you see, those things are heavy. We're talking like 30 pounds of minimum equipment. So I'm over there when we get to Baghdad with my little camera, and I've got this helmet on, and I'm kind of huffing around, and it was a trip. It was absolutely amazing. And when we got into Baghdad, we flew from Kuwait in a C-131, and we had to do what they call a corkscrew landing, and it basically you go like this, and then you kind of do this very rapid descent, because the fear is that the insurgency and the terrorists, they have these shoulder kind of missile things, and they can shoot a slowly descending plane. And so we did this kind of fast descent, which was kind of, I thought it was maybe an e-ticket at Disneyland in the old days, but it was pretty cool. And by the time we got there, we all had sleeping bags, and there were tents with, I don't know, maybe 30 cots, and they were air-conditioned. And boy, that was so cool because it was 120 degrees out there, plus your flak jacket and your helmet and your stuff. I mean, it was the most, physically, it was probably one of the most demanding things I've ever done in my life. And I'm not a spring chicken anymore. It's not like I was in high school running in football pads, but it was heavier than that. And so a couple of the highlights while we were there, we originally were cloistered to Camp Victory, and they were going to let us do our broadcast there. And there's a doctor in Camp Prosperity, which was down in the green zone, which means you have to go through what they call the death mile. They call it Irish, the road Irish. They say it's the most dangerous road on earth. And we had they call him Doc. It's Captain Daniel Green, Jewish doctor out of Atlanta, one of the most charming characters on the planet. He's kind of like a nurturing Jewish mother on one hand, smoking a cigar on the other hand, if you can imagine. Personable, everybody loves him because he's a doctor. Doc, I heard here, I heard there, and he takes out his little, you know, said, okay, well, let's see, I got one of these, and give, you know. So he's always healing people. And he's very honest and very direct. He's got a blog, and there's encouraging things that he talks about and discouraging things. And ultimately, he makes the point, he says, you know, it's an honor to fight for people that don't have the capability to fight for themselves yet. And now here's a guy that, he's a doctor, and he's in the National Guard and the Reserves. And it was because of him we got permission to go into the Green Zone. And so, and everything changed like every 4 hours. It was really very interesting. So, okay, pack up, we're going to go. We went to this place where we check in at 9 o'clock at night. They said between 10 and 4 in the morning, we're going to have you load up and we're going to go the 8 miles, and we'll go about 70, 80 miles an hour, and we'll haul buns to get there. And it was about 3:30 in the morning. So, you know, like I say, you're in the Army now and hurry up and wait. We hurry up and we waited so much of that trip, and we literally averaged most of the time about 2 to 3, maybe 4 hours a night of sleep. But you know, you're like pumped on adrenaline. And so we made it down to the Green Zone into a place, to a castle called Camp Prosperity. And it was one of Saddam Hussein's castles. And they made it a forward operating base, and apparently he'd never been in the capsule. He either built it for his son or his mistresses, I was told. And they basically brought us in, and they were going to allow us, and they did. I, unfortunately, for whatever reason, couldn't go into the red zone, into real Baghdad, on patrol. I had an appointment with the Army Corps of Engineers that I'd made previously, creating an alliance to get some footage on reconstruction projects. And I was going to go out in the morning, and both patrols, they had scheduling conflicts. But there were part of our team that went out into the red zone, and they went into the neighborhoods, and, you know, they didn't have guns. You could tell they were civilians, but they had the flak jacket and helmets on. And they ended up going to an orphanage, because the soldiers take milk to the orphans on a regular basis. And if you can imagine, a big strapping soldier with a flak jacket and helmet and a gun, driving in a Humvee or a Bradley, walking into this orphanage, taking milk to these little babies in 115 degrees in the shade type of heat. And as the story was told to me, and I wasn't there, I'm waiting for some video from my associate filmmaker, Brad Maskey. When he and the gal that was in the team were describing the scene, they said we were walking when the little babies heard the soldiers' boots, you would see these little arms reach up from the cribs, reaching out to the soldiers. Now, when they're telling me this, I'm starting to get kind of teary-eyed. And, you know, I'm a guy; I'm not supposed to cry easily, but I'm just tearing up. It was one of the most powerful, I guess, examples of a complete human being, protecting him on one hand and providing for him on another hand. And as they went through, in fact, we've adopted that orphanage. And I'll probably, if anybody wants to get on my mailing email list and have that opportunity, we're going to probably do some things to send them bottles and whatever their list. They don't need any more soccer balls and no more candy, they said. You get tons of that, but real stuff. But as they left, the Iraqi people, and this is like 3-4 weeks ago, or I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks ago, the Iraqi people would, this is in Baghdad too, and not in necessarily a good neighborhood of Baghdad, would come out and say, America, yes, freedom, thank you. And they didn't know a lot of English. And they would come up and they would hug these people. And the most striking thing is, I didn't hear that kind of thing in the media. I heard all the bad stuff. In fact, I don't know if you remember about that time, about a mile or two away, there were some soldiers passing out candies to, I think there were about 17 or 18 kids, and a suicide bomber came up and blew them all up. And the type of what happens in this world when there's the absence of God is amazing. And so as I think about the journey, oh, and just because I have to answer the question, I woke up in Saddam's palace. I actually went out in a Humvee, and have any of you remember the clip where you see Saddam shooting the gun and there's the parade thing? I was there. That's where I got to go. And there's a little Iraqi guy that came up and he sold me an Iraqi flag, and he was just so excited to have the opportunity to make a living. And so I went to my appointment, I came back, and I actually went to lay down for like, you know, 20 minutes, and 20 minutes turned into about 4 hours, I think. And I thought it was a great header. I woke up surprised or disoriented in Saddam's palace. And I did. I woke up and I was so tired. My eyes, I looked around and I thought, am I dreaming? And then I looked around again, and, you know, the ceilings were like 30 feet high. And so I was in Sodom's Palace. And then we continued on, and we broadcast from the Green Zone, and the soldiers that were there were so thankful. They were so thankful that we supported them, and they knew their mission. And one of the reasons I embarked on this whole Iraqi thing is I'm a pragmatist. I'm not a Republican or Democrat. I'm not on either side, and politically, because it's such a divisive issue. I wanted to go myself, because I heard so many things, and I hear, yeah, this side yelling, and this side yelling, and, you know, all of this stuff. I wanted to go and see it myself, so I could say with my eyes, I've seen it, and I can report this, this, and this. Now, somebody else might report this, that, and the other thing, but at least I could report what I've seen. And it was one of the most amazing experiences to see the hope in these people. 90% of Iraq is forward thinking. There's about 10% that's a problem. It's kind of in that thing, and that's what gets all the media attention. And they got a shot. I don't think it's a guarantee, but they've got a shot. Okay, now how do we tie that into church? Because this is kind of a church thing. I want to share with you, if I may, a verse, about three or four verses from 1 Peter. And as I thought about the contrast in the last month of my own life, you know, I went to Iraq, and it was very different than living in Encinitas, California, by the beach, in what feels like paradise, especially when you come back. And then in the last couple of days with the hurricane, almost like our own tsunami, there's probably thousands that have died. And those that are alive are sweltering under the heat and dehydration and very difficult physical circumstances. And I find it interesting in our culture, and we're very cloistered historically, we live in a very, this experiment of democracy is what a privilege that we have. We have so many opportunities in this country. But we talk a lot about abundance. We talk a lot about bliss, you know, those spiritual, fuzzy, warm, fuzzy feelings. How do we make ourselves feel better? And sometimes I think we get mixed up with what makes us feel better and what makes us holy. There's a difference. There's that pain-pleasure principle in life that in our natural self we seek things that are pleasurable, things that, you know, the absence, we go towards pleasures and away from pain. And the truth of the matter is, as we pursue our spiritual journey, God is concerned about your character more than he is about your warm fuzzies and mine. And I thought it kind of interesting because when I was over there and it was 120 degrees and it was hot, very hot. And to think of the character experiences that I went through over there and kind of the shift in my own paradigm was amazing. Peter, in the first century, wrote a book, 1 Peter, in the Bible. And he wrote in a time of Nero. Nero was the emperor, the main guy. He used Christians as kind of toys. He put them in the Colosseum and he'd blindfold them and he'd put the chariots in there with the sharp, the wheels and the, like the sword deals, and he just cut them up. And it was sport. Very barbaric. In fact, it's been written in history that he would take Christians who claimed Jesus as the way, and he would put them in his garden and light them on fire. Barbaric. Not much different than Saddam Hussein, or Pol Pot of Cambodia, or we could name any number of mass killers in our century alone. But he writes in that context, and he says, you know, Peter, an apostle, I'll read a few verses, and then there's one little word picture I want to share with you. Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to God's elect, strangers in the world, scattered throughout Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia Bithynia, San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and all the United States, or something like that, who have been chosen according to the foreknowledge of God the Father, the sanctifying work of the Spirit, for obedience to Jesus Christ, and sprinkling by his blood, grace and peace to you in abundance. Then he goes on and he says, praise be to God the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us new birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Christ from the dead and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade, kept in heaven for you, who through faith are shielded by God's power until the coming wholeness or salvation or union with God that is ready to be revealed at the final day. Now this is it. In this you greatly rejoice. Now these are people in the first century that things weren't good. Their environment was hostile, very difficult. Kind of like in the tsunami, you're at that very base level of living. You're thankful that you're breathing, or maybe you're not, you want to die. But you're at that level. And you really come to this understanding that, you know, there's an exterior world and there's an interior world. Our spiritual life is in that interior zone. And sometimes it takes heat from the outside to drive us to look to the inside. You know what I mean? And so he says, in this you greatly rejoice, though now, for a little while, a little period of time, you may have to suffer grief in all kinds of trials and measures. These have come so that your faith of greater worth than gold, which perishes, even though refined by fire, may prove to be genuine and may result in praise. Peter uses a very interesting phrase in Greek. Refined by fire. And it's the picture of an ancient goldsmith taking gold in its raw format, putting it in an iron crucible. And he put the gold in, and then he'd fire up underneath, and all of the impurities that were in the gold would rise to the surface as the heat rose. And what happened is when he got it to a certain temperature, he'd look down, the goldsmith would look down into the top of the gold, and he would take off with kind of a spoon all of the impurities, and he could tell if it was pure gold if he looked down and saw his image in the gold. Think about the application. When we go through life and we go through difficult times, and sometimes, you know, we moan and complain and, oh, things are so tough and so on and so forth, when the reality is sometimes God needs to turn the heat up on us so that he can test our responses of, are we looking to the external world for our response and our security, or do we look to our internal world where our wholeness, our relationship with God, where our salvation is from? And so when you go through the trials and tribulations and you find the kinds of impure responses or the selfishness or the complaining or whatever it might be, it's the beautiful opportunity for you to look up at your Lord and say, God, confess it. You know, I was this, I was that. Help me. Take the spoon off the top of my gold. Take the impurities away so that when the heat's high, and when people in the world see me under these kinds of trials and tribulations, they would see your face. Isn't that powerful? They would see the image of God through our very physical lives. So it's not always about abundance. I spoke, I don't know, last few months ago on the prayer of Jabez. And Jabez said, God, bless me indeed. Bless me big time. Bring it on. Lay it on me. Enlarge my territory. Keep your hand upon me. Keep me from evil. so that I may cause no pain. And it's almost like there's a conflict there. But really there's not. Because life is a whole process. And when James says, count it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials, knowing that these trials and tribulations create endurance and perseverance in the perfection of your faith. The goldsmith heats up the gold to get the impurities. God heats up the trials in your life and mine to find out how we respond, how we cling to life on the external world, or how we turn inward to our source and allow that grace of God and that love of God, which is the most incredible testimony to people. And you know, I'm sure that all of you, you know, when you see a spiritual person, and they kind of have a quiet grace to them, kind of a simplicity. I get too complicated in life. So when the heat turns on, count it joy. Count it as an opportunity to understand what's impure inside the soul. And at that point, God wants to lovingly embrace it, take it off, and have that kind of communion so that He can create that dynamic power in you and through you to show a world His very character. That's the ultimate purpose of our lives, is to show the pure image of God, to be a light to the world. That's it. Thank you.